Today's Taisho is on case 37 in the Mumonkan, the Wu Man Kwan. Case 37 is entitled Joshu's Oak Tree. A monk asked Joshu, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to China?" Joshu said, "The oak tree in the garden." Mumon's comment, if you understand Joshu's answer intimately, there is no Shakyamuni before you, no Maitreya to come. Mumon's verse, words cannot express things, speech does not convey the spirit. Swayed by words, one is lost. Blocked by phrases, one is bewildered. Again, I want to thank everybody for doing such a superb job in the Zendo this morning with those three sits. People sit so still. It's rather unusual to do such a long sitting in the morning. There are many places that have a different style of practice and they might have a walking meditation in between. But, that kind of sustained morning sitting when your mind is very clear upon getting up is really precious, really priceless. And people sit so well, you know, even though it's a challenge, you have to really concentrate. Everybody was so still. It's really deeply purifying body, mind, and heart to sit that way. And of course, it's especially wonderful to do it with other people. You know, everybody here was doing his or her best, and really the result was quite impressive. You know, Sesshin, as I mentioned earlier, I think of as this magical invention. And there's really nothing like it, and where people dedicating themselves to enlightenment, meditate for 8 or more hours every day, and cooperating and assisting one another in this, with this most amazing generosity, So, just coming to Sesshin shows you have a great openness. Great trust in life. There are a number of people here who are here for the first time and just jumped in. That's really unusual. People tend to have conditions, want a contract with the universe. But everybody here came without conditions, without a contract. You put your hands in the universe. You put yourself, rather, in the universe's hands. And you trusted the process of Sesshin without, in some cases, even knowing what Sesshin is. So I think that's really admirable and quite unusual. People have demonstrated again and again throughout the Sesshin great determination. Right, this great determination. Today again, people sitting so well. And also, this third element that I mentioned earlier in the week, the third pillar of Zen is great doubt or great questioning. I have to know. I have to pull the curtain back and I have to know. I think that spirit is animating everybody here. It's not enough to read it in a book. It's not enough to hear it from an authority. You have to know in your flesh and in your bones what the truth is. So Zen, is a really interesting process because, it's based upon allowing the student to learn for herself. See? We could definitely have like a class in Yogacara Buddhism, Yogacara Buddhism. You know, Chan or Zen is really Yogacara Buddhism. It's really the psychological school of Buddhism. Sometimes it's called the mind school. And so, you know, we could actually have a class, and, you know, I could give lectures and people could take notes. And it might seem convincing to you. But, you know, you really wouldn't know it in your flesh and in your bones unless you find it yourself. You know, so just having somebody tell you something isn't the same as discovering it for yourself. Now, you know, if you were just turned, you know, there are people who don't belong to any kind of community. They just want to discover it for themselves, and they read books from various traditions, which is wonderful, please feel free, and they practice meditation on their own. And I think that's a very hit or miss, you know, actually. Earlier in the week I mentioned that a certain number of people have come to our community over the years, and they'll meet with me and say, you know, I'm already enlightened. And I'll say, okay, well, in fact, this happened last year. A guy came, and he said, you know, I think I'm enlightened. I'd like you to evaluate me. Isn't that... But in Zen tradition, there's actually this tradition of assessing people's state of awareness through koans. So he had read about, in Zen tradition, Lin Ji actually had said, you know, I can tell a person's state of awareness in the following ways, and then he explained how he can tell. So he said, I'd like you to, you're a Zen teacher, I'd like you to evaluate my, and he went into this long spiel, you know, and I said, yeah, that's great, you know, but let's sit together, then I'll know. And after about 15 minutes he was moving around. So, you know, he wasn't really able to get into deep samadhi. So after the sit, he said, well, what do you think? And I think he was thinking I was going to bow, you know, one master to another. And I said, you're a beginner. And he was furious, right? And he actually wrote me angry emails telling me what a phony I was. You know, basically, this is like the self-made person, right? Now, you know, in Buddhist tradition, there is a tradition of people who actually wake up on their own. There's actually a term for this. They're called Pratyeka Buddhas. These are called solitary Buddhas, right? You know, throughout human history, there are people who wake up on their own. They discover the truth of impermanence, suffering, and the end of suffering. They see through the illusion of the self, and so on. They discover emptiness. They discover Buddha nature. There are such people on their own. The Buddhist tradition says, yes, those people have existed for all times. You know, often they're in communities. They did it by accident. You know, they accidentally stumbled into this. Or maybe they were very acutely intelligent and they practiced a lot. But, you know, they were in societies that didn't tolerate these kind of insights or... you know, whatever, the factors weren't right, the cooperating causes weren't right. But so, you know, it takes a village, it takes a sangha. You need a sangha, you need a community. And we all benefit from the structure of sesshin, right? You know, we benefit from this highly regimented structure. You know, if you wanted to do this on your own, it'd be very hard. You know, you might be able to do one day like sesshin. It'd be very hard to do five, right? You know, and I doubt you could do one day. I think, you know, after so many hours of sitting, you just say, okay, well, that's it for today. You know, the social pressure, the structure, the institution of sesshin, you know, makes everybody try their hardest and go beyond, you know, what they think of as their limits. So we definitely need a structure. We need we need, it's better to practice with a teacher than to practice on your own. If you please look for a teacher you like, but it's better to have a trusted teacher than to try to invent the wheel on your own. Unlikely to happen. A lot of people wind up like my friend coming to the Zendo and telling me that they're already enlightened and not able to sit for 15 minutes without squirming. I also met a guy, believe it or not, who actually came to the sits. We used to have sits up in Blairstown, and he came to the sit, and he also claimed to be enlightened. And I said, "Why don't you sit with us?" And he was phobic about sitting with other people. He said, "I'll sit on my own and I'll videotape it and send it to you." Really, it takes all kinds, So I said, "Well, that's okay, You can't sit with us, That's so." He had issues. But, so you benefit from a structure. But on the other hand, if the teacher tells you what you should discover, that's not good either. So there has to be like a balance, right, between structure and your freedom as somebody who's asking questions about the world. And I think Sesshin does a great job with that. Because, the structure of the Sesshin is for the teacher to give you a task, and then turn you loose and let you discover on your own. See, so instead of saying every moment is unique, the teacher might just give you a koan, like Umon's particle after particle of samadhi. See, so the teacher says, particle after particle of samadhi, that's your koan. It's like, huh? So, what samadhi is, you get into samadhi when you meditate. But what are these particles, right? So you're sitting there saying, particle, particle, particle. And, for a long time, you're just banging around in the dark, right? But sooner or later, you begin to notice that, actually, every moment of consciousness is a discrete moment. We say, I'm doing two things at once, but actually it's not possible to do two things at once. Every moment of consciousness is just a moment of consciousness. This is like one, you're aware. It may seem like things are happening at the same time, but the mind doesn't work like that. If you observe the mind very carefully, you hear the crunching of the tires on the gravel, then you feel the pain in your leg, then you hear the cicadas, then you feel the pain in your leg, then you feel the gravel, then you realize you're hungry, then the pain in your leg, and so on, right? So it's like that these are actually moments of consciousness. And consciousness is really like a river with these made up of these little moments. This. And they're all quite different. They have different characteristics. And we can even go into it a little farther. In Buddhist thinking, in Zen we say that there, the moment has a structure that's quite predictable. And in Japanese, I don't know what they're called in Mandarin, but in Japanese these moments are called nen, N-E-N. So, actually every moment begins with a pure, uninterpreted experience. So first you hear, this noise, and then you think crunching, gravel, car, tire, So you have an experience of just this sound, right, this crunchy sound. And then you think car tire. Right, and then you wonder what are they driving there for? Maybe then you might think they're not supposed to be driving in front of the Zendo, And then you get angry, right? Right. So that's there's a pure experience, an interpretation with language, and then an emotional response. And I defy you to find any moment that doesn't have these three characteristics. So every moment is like this. Pure experience, intellectual understanding, you put it in a you pigeonhole it somewhere, and then you have an emotional response, like crunchy, car driving, pissed off, right? You know. And by the way, let me just say, you know, they have their service on Sundays, and many of their parishioners are very old and really can't walk the distance to their meeting house. So, you know, they try to drive very slowly so as not to disturb us. And it's good practice, right? I mean, you know, every morning it's been so still and quiet and we can listen to the cicadas humming away. And now suddenly there are these rude, crunchy noises, right? And but if you get mad at them, if you resist them, they get more irritating, right? So it's a good lesson. You know, if you become one with the sound of the gravel crunching, the problem goes away. If you fight it, it intensifies, right? And it's like every gravel becomes annoying, right? But that's your response. You know, if you become one with the crunchiness, see, it's a funny. It's a, like, a, it's, you know, it's fine, you know. It's sort of fun to be crunchy, you know. That's just an aside, but it's a style. Now, but you can discover that for yourself, right? You know, you could come to the next 10 sessions and every goddamn Sunday, right, there's this driving, that crunching tires, and you could get so mad about this. And then one day you might just think, oh, screw it. And then they just go by and you think, you know, that's not so bad, you know. So that's discovering something for yourself. So same thing with particle after particle of samadhi. The teacher gives you this cryptic statement and you sit and you go into to mushin and you say particle, particle, particle. And, you know, for a long time you might just come into the teacher and say, I have no idea what this is about. You know, particles, what are the particles? You know, and you know, but eventually you begin to realize, well, wait a minute, you know, I do notice that there, you know, I'm aware of this, then I'm aware of this, then I'm aware of this. You know, it's unlikely in one session you would discover nens, you know, that each moment has this structure and so on. But you probably would discover the particles in a couple of sessions. You'd realize there are moments of awareness. And you might not put it that way to the teacher, but you might notice that, you know, the consciousness is like a river, or that there are these little intervals or something. I don't know. Everybody's going to notice, experience it a little differently. But, you know, when you come in to tell me, you know, I realize that there are particles. You know, first I hear this, then I feel this, then I hear this, then I feel this. You know, if that would be a really good answer. But if you came in and told me that, see, I didn't tell you that. You discovered it for yourself. And I think there's a world of difference. You know, I'm a teacher, and I've taught many different ways. And if you want to have a horrible, boring class, you know, come in and lecture your students. Because, you know, unless the students are, I mean, if they're graduate students and they're interested in what you're teaching, or they're upper division students who are interested, that's different. So, you know, if you're teaching an advanced group of students and they're all interested in your subject, you know, they care about your subject. But if you're teaching a big survey course and these people just signed up because your course is at 10:10 in the morning, right? What's the subject of this course again, right? And you come in and lecture, you know, they're reading the Targum, they're doing whatever, you know. You look around, people are eating, you know, they're texting, of course, you know. So that's a nightmare, right? So it's much better to give students projects rather than give them information. So you find the information. So here's your job. Your job is to report to the class on this, your team. And they all go do the work and they get tangled up and confused, and they come to you for help and say, we don't know how to make sense of this. You know, and then that's like heaven, right? Because it's like, oh, now you're interested, now you're asking questions, now you're confused, you know, wonderful, right? So they're not passively taking it in, they're actively finding for themselves. And when they discover things, you know, it's like they made a real discovery. You know, and I learn things from my students when I teach that way. It's like, you guys found that? Really? You know? So you know, Zen style of teaching is really a wonderful style of teaching because it says, you do need a structure. We don't just say, observe the universe and let me know, right? We say, let's focus in on one thing. Let's focus in on one thing. You know, why do you, at the sound of the bell, why do you put on your seven-piece robe? Now that has two parts. The first part is the sound, is sound, right? Sound. So people start listening. They listen to things all day long, 8 hours a day, you know, 7 days, 5 days, 2 days, and they come in and report, you know, and at first they say, I don't know, sound, you know, sounds, yeah, there's sounds, right? But, you know, you go into deep samadhi and you go back to zero, when your mind becomes blank, see, now you're deconditioning yourself, and you begin to experience things in a fresh way. You've got to go back to zero to experience things in a fresh way. And then, you know, you keep going back to zero, going back to zero, going back to zero, and then all of a sudden you realize, that's funny. You know, there's something sound, you know. When I listen to the sound, this happens, you know, to me. And it might take two or three sessions to have that experience, but when it does, you know, it can be, you know, people come in sometimes, they're astonished. They'll say, I can't believe this just happened. Here's what happened. And they're astonished because they discovered it, right? I didn't tell them, here's how it is. You know, I set a perimeter. I set a task, and I said, go do this. And they did it and found their own answer. This is how Zen works. So the whole structure of Zen practice is based on this idea of the teacher giving you a question, letting you try to answer it. And, you know, and this is so good in so many ways. You know, people don't always have confidence in themselves, and it builds confidence. People have negative self-destructive qualities sometimes, and they have to work through those. They have to be independent, curious, problem-solving people, right? And energetic. You have to, you know, you realize that nobody's going to, you know, as I experienced many times, you know, nobody's going to answer this koan for me. I can rip off somebody else's answer, but the teacher's not going to accept peach as my answer to the breath koan, right? So basically, you know, I can stick with this koan till the cows come home, right? You know, I can start Zen in 1976, and I could be doing the same koan in 2076, you know, and the teacher would be fine with that, right? So I've got to solve the problem, right? So what do? You know, I keep saying particle and nothing's happening. You know, I look at particles everywhere. I see this looks like a particle, this looks... Sooner or later, you realize, well, it's clearly not this. You know, it's got, you know, what about this? And you begin to intuit something, right? Your big mind, your unconscious mind helps you to select the right details. So this is what Zen practice is all about. Let me just say that, you know, this takes a certain kind of attention or attentiveness. Especially beginners might be a little confused about the difference between contemplation and meditation. See, and in the West, actually, those two words are often mixed up. So in the West, you know, they talk about religious meditation, and they really mean contemplation. So like, you could study some lines from Torah or from the Bible, from script from the New Testament, and you could say, you know, sufficient unto the day is the good thereof, or something like that. And you could just sit there and say, sufficient unto the day. What does that mean? And what does that really mean? You know, I'm always trying to do more. I'm always trying to be happier. Maybe I should just be happy with what I've got, you know. That's contemplation, right? The wicked flourish like the green bay tree, right? You say, oh, why is, you know, they do, you know? Look who's president, you know? Wicked flourish like the green bay tree, you know? That's, I mean, so unjust, you know? Then you think, well, but maybe there's a bigger plan, right? You know, so that's contemplation. That's not really what we do in Zen. We do meditation. And meditation, there is a contemplative element to meditation, but it's, meditation is primarily quite distinct. So, you know, what we do is learn how to enter samadhi, deep samadhi, and then we learn to enter, we learn to fuse ourselves with the breath and enter mushin, empty mind, wuxin. Wuxin. And that's the foundation of Zen practice. And then, you know, Zen practice is a little bit like science. It's a little bit like science, right? You know, we're looking, you know, particle after particle of samadhi. They're really not asking you to think about, you know, history of thought or philosophy. They're not asking you to contemplate. You go into deep wuxin. And then you just say particle, particle. And, you know, your unconscious mind is going to help you by directing your attention to something in the world around you. And your conscious mind might never guess, you know, but your unconscious mind is going to help you figure it out. You know, you have an active unconscious mind that is constantly knitting, weaving together the world of your experience. It's this amazing loom that's weaving together out of the threads of your senses this rich tapestry that we call the real world. And, you know, you get up in the morning and you walk outside, 20,000 different things are happening. But you hear the cicada, and you see the zinnia. Now somebody else comes out of his room and walks out and doesn't hear the cicada. He hears the seagull, and he notices the grass. See, and so you didn't choose to see. You didn't choose to hear the cicada. You didn't choose to see the zinnia. You just saw them. Why? You say, oh, it's an accident. It's not quite an accident, right? Your unconscious mind is your master. The unconscious mind is weaving together the fabric of your reality. Before you even wake up in the morning, it's doing it. And you walk outside, the world is appearing, arising before you, thanks to the work of this mind. So we trust the big mind, the unconscious mind. It's like, in, you know, under the surface is the tip of the iceberg is consciousness. And under the surface is this giant iceberg. Only, you know, it's not inert. It's trying to help you wake up all the time. It's coming up behind you. It's right behind you. And it's making your eyes bigger. So this is the big mind, and this is our secret ally, in trying to answer our koans. But the spirit of answering the koan is not philosophical or contemplative. We're not reflecting on things. We're posing a question that might make no sense, going into emptiness, and then allowing the big mind to produce an answer. And you just let the big mind, you have to get out of the way and start seeing. The koan is taking you on a journey. Where is it taking you? And you can't control it. You know, you might want the answer tomorrow, but that just screws everything up. You have to just go on the journey. You know, it is a little like science. You know, if you say, I've got to get results in a month, right, that would be crazy, right? If you're posing a research problem, you have to set it up, and then you don't know how it's going to turn out, you know? And it might prove your whole hypothesis might turn out to be completely wrong after like 3 or 4 years of research. And then you're in real trouble, right? But you can't say, I've got to get the answer in 7 days, right? That's not going to work out. It's true for Sesshin too. You know, it's experientially based. It's experientially based. It's not contemplation. Now, it is definitely true that when you're working with your koan, you have insights, right? So you go into Mushin, you're saying, you know, some koans have a psychological or existential dimension. So you're, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. See, and you know, you keep saying, give, take, give, you know, and all of a sudden you begin to feel angry because you realize your parents really loved your brother more than they loved you. And you know, when he came home, they were fascinated by what he did. And when you tried to show them what you did, they said, yeah, you know. And when it was his birthday, you know, they just were having a wonderful time. It was your birthday, they gave you a cake, they gave you a hat, you know, but it wasn't the same thing. And if you confronted them, you said, but you love him. No, we love you equally. And then when he comes home, they have a big smile on their face, right? And when you come home, they sort of have a little smile, right? So those things can come up on the cushion. Now, that's not contemplation. That's part of the meditation practice. That's more like psychotherapy. There's a dimension of that that's a little like psychotherapy, where these unexpected insights are coming up without your even knowing it. And you know, basically, we often work those through. So, you know, you realize your parents did like your brother more than you. They loved him more. You feel hurt, angry, etc., etc. You keep going into Mushin. You know, at some point, that all dissolves, and you feel free. Okay, that happened to me. And you realize it's made you maybe unwilling to have certain kinds of relationships. But when it all dissolves, you realize I'm free, I feel happy, I feel connected. You know, maybe that will give you the courage now to experiment in your relationships or do other things with your life. So these are two really different roads. You know, the foundation of Zen practice is Wuxing, going into Mushin, going back to zero and then looking. In Chinese Buddhism, this is called stopping and seeing. Stopping and seeing. So stopping is going into deep Wuxing, and seeing is looking. Or another, in Indian tradition, this is called shamatha and vipassana, like mindfulness. But mindfulness is a little too narrow. It's looking. So, you know, basically, first Mushin, then looking. And with the help of the unconscious mind. So if you're just beginning this wonderful road of Zen, the Buddha said it's beautiful at the beginning, it's beautiful in the middle, and it's beautiful at the end. And I am very sad it's day 5 of Sesshin. I wish it weren't, because if you do this for a while, it's like going to heaven. And by the way, I've been doing Zen for 40 years, and I hope I live another 40 years just so I can keep doing this. You know, it's challenging. It's, you know, the first 20 years are hard. After that, it's great. But when you're just starting out on this wonderful road, you know, it might be a little confusion about this. That you do get insights through practice, and I'm not putting those down. But, you know, if the teacher says, watch the breath, you know, don't assume you know what the breath is. You know, really watch the breath. Start from zero and watch the breath. And when the teacher says, where does the breath take you? Yes, it takes you out. That's a good answer, but there's more. So keep looking, looking, looking. What you want to avoid doing, actually, on the cushion is too much thinking. So, you know, when you start thinking, why do I always push people away? You know, I need to be more accepting of human flaws. You know, that's a wonderful insight, but it's not meditation. That's contemplation. So if you're spending time with that kind of thing, please spend less time doing that kind of thing and more of the other kind of thing that I'm talking about today. You know, it's probably the case that you're doing both at once, that you're going into deep samadhi, but you're also engaging in contemplation. And so what I would say is please, less contemplation now that you're in deep samadhi, more meditation. And it's very worthwhile. So anyway, now we get to the koan. It's 1 hour in. A monk asked Zhaozhou, What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to China? So what is Zen all about? What is Chan all about? And Zhaozhou says, he actually says the cypress tree. I don't know why he translates it as the oak tree, but it's the cypress. If you look, it's Mandarin is cypress tree. He says the cypress tree in the garden. See. What is the meaning, what is the ultimate meaning of the Buddha's teaching? He doesn't say transmigration. He doesn't say karma. He doesn't say hungry ghosts. He says the oak tree, the cypress tree in the garden. See, what Zhaozhou is really saying is, you know, you think you understand the cypress tree, but you need to experience the cypress tree from the standpoint of wuxin. You know, we see a cypress, you know, this probably was a cypress tree in the temple. Everybody walks by it on the way to dinner. Everybody walks by it on the way to the Nianfo Hall to recite the sutras together. But, you know, have you really seen the cypress? You know, and maybe, you know, you might think that the koan is asking you to, like, contemplate the cypress. So when you think about a cypress tree, it's evergreen, and you think, ah, yes, evergreen, you know, it never dies. You know, maybe that means this path is like, you know, eternal life. Or maybe, you know, you had a cypress tree at summer camp, and you think, oh, yeah, the old cypress tree, you know, whatever happened to Eddie and Bill, you know, that's wonderful. But that's contemplation, see. When you say cypress tree, you're supposed to go into deep wuxin. And you say cypress tree, blank mind, wuxi, go back to zero. And say cypress tree, cypress tree. You can even go outside and look, there are actually cypress trees around here. You can go sit and watch your breath until your mind goes blank and look at the cypress tree. You know, as sooner or later you're going to experience the cypress tree in a different way. You know, another way to put it is, you know, when we normally look at a cypress tree, what we're really seeing mostly are our projections on the cypress tree. So we look at cypress tree and we say, what an ugly tree. Or we look at the cypress tree and we say, Cuprosus Americanus, you know. You know, or we look at the cypress tree and we say, oh my gosh, you know, there's a cypress tree next to my dad's grave, you know, or whatever. You know, I remember the summer camp with Eddie and Bill. We used to climb the old cypress tree. Those are all projections on the tree. What Zen is asking you to do is to encounter the tree by stripping away those projections and having a face-to-face direct experience of something that is in a certain way absolutely unknowable. So how do you experience the unknowable? How do you experience the unknowable? When you strip away all the projections, what's left? Well, my old teacher Genki Roshi used to say, and it only took me 40 years to figure this out, used to say we can't really understand anything, but we can become one with it. See? So when you strip all the projections away, you become one with the cypress tree. This is the method of Zen. When you hear irritating gravel, cars driving over the gravel, and you get mad, see, become one with the sound. See, become one with the sound. This is the method of Zen. That's to know the sound, is to become one with, ultimately, everything is unknowable. So the only way to experience things open-heartedly is to become one. As Mumon says, words cannot express things. Speech does not convey the spirit. Swayed by words, one is lost. Blocked by phrases, one is bewildered. You know, words are just like, you know, money. Words are like money. We didn't invent them. They circulate, and we use them to have experiences. So, you know, basically, when, you know, when I was, I made a terrible mistake once of going on to rate my professor. I run a writing program at Rutgers that serves 18,000 students a year. And in English 101, 8% of those students fail the course. And I am the boss. And that means every year about 300, this is 8% of, you know, 4,000. That means about 300 to 400 students fail that class every year. And they all go on rate for my professor, and they give it to me, right? So anyway, I went on rate my professor, and I had like, there's something called the hotness score. Okay. When you rate your teacher in terms of hotness, see, you know, those are words, right? You know, when I was young, there used to be a movie called The Ten. And it's about this beautiful woman, and she's a ten, right? So basically, young men were encouraged to rate all women they see on a numerical scale. See, this is like, actually, Buddhism doesn't really believe in evil. We call it ignorance, but this is like evil, right? So what you're doing is you're making the real person disappear, and you're making the category real. And we do that all the time, and it's violence. It's violence, right? You can't experience anything in an open-hearted, honest way when you trust language. Language is just a stereotype. Like, cypress tree is not the tree. It's a stereotype. All language is a stereotype. We have to use words. I'm using them right now. But, you know, we have to cut through the illusion of knowledge that words create. Words point to things, but they really obscure their essential reality. So, words cannot express things. Speech does not convey the spirit. Swayed by words, one is lost. Blocked by phrases, one is bewildered.